This is Faith of Our Fathers broadcast with Pastor R.D. Smith.
Changes, men, but never changes. And God's truth must keep marching on. On and on.
Let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for today, and we thank you for your Holy Spirit who is able to enlighten us, Lord, to bring us to understanding of your word and your truths. And we pray this morning as you anoint Bo to speak forth your words that we would receive it, Lord, and we would become more like you. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Come on, Bo. He doesn't need an introduction anymore. He's one of us. You can clap if you want.
Oh, actually, take this. I gotta.
You don't want that.
Yeah, I don't want that. Actually, every time I see a thermos, I'm thinking, this is a perfect proof that the federal government is lying to us, and we're believing every word they say. We're so incredibly stupid. Every time we use a thermos, we should stop and think the federal government is the biggest liar on this planet. They never said a single word of truth, and we still believe them, even though we use this, which is a very good proof that they are lying to us. But I'll get to it later. Just remind me. What I wanted to talk to you today in the Sunday school was actually, it's an old article of mine, and the reason I wanted to go back to it is because I've been asked a few times, what about when people ask us about mathematics and physics and all this stuff, how does this tie into your claims that Christianity speaks all of truth, and you can only come to truth through Christianity? Isn't God silent in the areas of mathematics, in the areas of physics, engineering, chemistry? Isn't God silent in those areas? How do you preach God? How do you testify for God in areas like this? And we really don't have any good testimony there, because honestly, you can be a Hindu and you can do math. Or you can be an atheist and you can do biology. And you can be anything and you can do any kind of science, so God is not speaking in the area of science. Back in 1990, Murray Rothbard, who is a great guy, a great name, and we should treat the guy with respect, even though he was an atheist Jew, we still need to treat him with a lot of respect, because his mind was open to see a lot of truths in God's creation and in the way God organized societies. He was still very critical to our Christian faith. And he criticized one of my heroes, Gary North, about what he said about Christianity being the only way to the truth. And he said, and he asked, is there a Christian way to fly a plane? If everything's got to be Christian, is there a Christian way to fly a plane? Here's my answer to it today. And my answer is titled, is there a non-Christian way to fly a plane? Okay, and we're going to talk about it. How many of you know who Murray Rothbard is? Okay, you don't. How many are familiar with... Not many are familiar with his writings. Murray Rothbard is a great libertarian author. He wrote a lot of books about liberty, defending liberty. Unfortunately, he based his ideas he attacked socialism, he defended capitalism, he defended everything in the political realm that we hold dear to us. And this is the freedom of man to express himself in the works of his hands without being oppressed by a government that confiscates the fruits of his labor. And Murray Rothbard wrote quite a few good books about it. Actually, R.J. Rushtuni believed that Murray Rothbard was one of the greatest influences in his life, and they were very good friends. And in fact, if you go to the Journal of Christian Reconstruction, a publication published by Chalcedon, a Christianist organization, there is only one non-believer that ever wrote articles for the Journal of Christian Reconstruction. And that was Murray Rothbard. So he was an important guy. But he was still deceived about some things. So, you probably don't, if you don't know much about Murray Rothbard, I'm going to explain to you how he thought about things. Let's say you're talking, you're in a room and talking to a socialist and Murray Rothbard, okay? And imagine the socialist makes the following argument. There isn't a capitalist or a socialist way to help the poor, a socialist will say. There's only one way. Give money to the poor to buy the goods they need. And this is the way you help the poor, right? Isn't that what the federal government is doing today? We want to help the poor. What do? We give them money. Oh, well, I give them food stamps or whatever, but it's money, right? And we help the poor. What would Murray Rothbard reply to it? And I've read a lot of Murray Rothbard, so this is the way he's going to reply to it is going to be this. You, my socialist friend, propose a solution that assumes the existence of too many things. Assumes the existence of too many things. But all these things, in order to be there, will require capitalism first and foremost before you can actually use them to help the poor. For your solution to work, you first need the money. Okay? Someone needs to have made the money, in fact, a surplus of money, not just make the money, but a surplus of money, okay, in order to take some of that surplus and give it to the poor. So you need a surplus of money, and a surplus of money in itself is a capitalist concept. Because what is a capitalist working for? For profit. And what is profit? A surplus on top of what you already have, what you already put into that thing, right? You got to get it back plus a surplus on top of it, which we call profit. Of course, that money in itself has no value. The poor must go to the market because, I mean, the last time I checked, nobody eats money. I mean, certainly nobody eats the federal government's money. But nobody eats even gold. Right? You can have all the gold in the world in your pocket and you can't eat it. You got to have something on the market against that gold. Right? Well, who will produce the goods on the market? The government? Someone needs to invest to build the production facilities. In the process, that someone is risking his own money. Okay? Someone needs to manage and organize labor. Someone needs to have sufficient incentive to take all these risks and do all the work. In other words, he needs profit. The profit must also cover his payments to other producers who also want profit for themselves. Because nobody's going to work for no profit. Okay? Otherwise, why would someone bother to engage in a costly and risky process except for the return on their money. So in order for the good to get, in order for the poor to get the goods against the money they have, you need a bunch of capitalists to produce those goods. But you need more than that. You need the valid context in which money really can be exchanged for goods. You need a market. You need people who would value money more than they value the goods they have. You know, because if I produce something for myself, in order for you to come to me and tell me, here's my money, I want your goods, I need to have a view of money that will value your money more than I value what I've produced. Otherwise, I'm not going to make that exchange. Okay? Not only that, I must value your money so much to be willing to produce a surplus of my own goods above what I need for myself and my family to exchange for your money. Otherwise, I'm not going to produce. Okay? You need a universal agreement between people what money is and also mechanisms for that agreement to be worked out in practice. You need a system of prices. Something predictable. to tell the different producers what to produce, how much to ask for it, and whether they need to improve their efficiency or not. Now, that system of prices needs to be kept in order by the voluntary decisions of millions of buyers and sellers every day and in every place. And without the market, without the system of prices, the money you give to the poor will be worthless. Because they'll be left with money, but nobody's going to want that money. Okay? And of course, you need a valid definition for a poor. Because poor is a relative term. Right? It makes sense only in comparison to wealthy. Before you know who is poor and who deserves your help, you need to have what kind of people in the society? Wealthy people in the society. Because how do you define poor unless you know who's wealthy? Okay? Those that have found a way to produce the surplus and have enough of it to share with the poor. Right? If you don't have the wealthy people to take money from them, and how did they become wealthy? Therefore, my socialist friend, Murray Rothbard, will say, before you have your solution, you need a thoroughly capitalist context, a thoroughly capitalist society in which to help your poor. In your eyes, what is visible, giving money to the poor, is neither socialist nor capitalist. In reality, though, behind it, you need all the invisible prerequisites to help you put your solution to practice, and they are only capitalist and nothing else. Therefore, there's only one way to help the poor, the capitalist way. That might not be the exact words Mr. Rothbard would say, but we can imagine his answer would follow pretty much the same logic. He was actually a very good presuppositionalist. He didn't realize that, but he was a good presuppositionalist. I'll go into that. Classical liberalism has taught all of us to pay attention to the context of that is not seen behind the things that are seen, and thus be informed about economic issues. And that's what made classical liberals such powerful and influential intellectual force in our society today. That's why it is so unfortunate when Murray Rothbard didn't use the same logic consistently when he addressed Christianity. That's amazing. You know, when he applied it to economics, but he refused to apply it to other fields like sociology, philosophy, religion. And the example I have in mind is that article of 1990, which was actually recently republished again, Kingdom Come, The Politics of the Millennium. And in that article, he says the following. And he actually criticizes Gary North, but that's okay if he criticizes Gary North. He's not unique in that. But he says, is there a Christian way to fly a plane? The irony of this passage is that the same paragraph where Murray Rothbard tells Gary North his presuppositionalism will meet only limited acceptance ends with the most presuppositional question he could ask. He actually proves presuppositionalism back to us. He is a presuppositionalist whether he admits it or not. Whether he is aware of it or not. Everyone takes something for granted. If you want to know the simplest exposition of presuppositionalism, it is everyone takes something for granted. Boy, that sounds so American, I know. Because everyone in America takes a lot of things for granted. Okay? But everyone takes something for granted when asking questions or trying to find answers. It is unavoidable. It is unavoidable part of every human thinking to take something for granted. Gary North is presuppositionalist when he writes his books. He takes God and his word for granted. And we all should take God and his word for granted, right? Because we're Christians. The socialist in my example above is a presuppositionalist when he makes his statement about helping the poor. He takes for granted money, goods, production, market, prices. He takes all of them for granted. Murray Rothbard is also a presuppositionalist when he asks his question, is there a Christian way to fly a plane? He takes the plane for granted. He takes it for granted that the plane just exists out of thin air, and then he asks the question, is there really a Christian way to fly this thing? He forgets to ask the question, how did it get there in the first place? How do we have the plane in the first place? But can we really take the plane for granted? This is my question. And this is basically where I want you to start listening very carefully, because we're going into Christian apologetics in areas that we haven't been into before. And we have lost our edge in those areas. We can't presuppose a plane out of thin air any more than a socialist can presuppose the existence of money, goods, production, exchange, markets. So in order to answer Mr. Rothbard's question, I need to apply in practice what I learned from him and from other classical liberals. Find out how that plane came to exist in the first place before I know if there's a Christian way to fly it. Let's see. A plane needs some knowledge of the laws of nature. Oh, we got to start with this. Some knowledge of the laws of nature. Well, before we have knowledge of the laws of nature, we need to start with a person who actually believes that nature has laws. We can't take that for granted. Okay? Or rather, not just one person, but a whole culture that believes that laws, that nature has laws. A whole culture, not just one person. One single transcendental principle of unity for all reality is basic to any system of knowledge. One single unified principle for all reality. If we don't believe that, we have no laws of nature. A culture, for example, that believes nature is a clash of benevolent and malevolent personal occult forces that just fight there in the jungle against each other would not develop a concept of laws of nature. Paganism never developed science. We also need that person or culture to believe that the human mind is actually capable of reliably discovering and understanding the laws of nature. It's not enough to believe that there are laws of nature. You also need to believe that your human mind can relate to those laws of nature and understand them and discover them. Okay? Hinduism, for example, believes that there are laws in nature, but it believes also that all perceptions are illusory. It never developed any science to talk about. Why? Because even if there are laws in nature, even if there is a unified principle in nature, the human mind is not capable of discovering it. Yeah. A society that believes, for example, that the human mind evolved randomly and is a random work of random chemical forces has no reason to believe human mind has any reliable connection to the outside world. Oh, you know what's happening in the American universities right now, right? Why we're losing our intellect in America and public schools as well. Why trust any laws that the human mind can discover if we don't believe that the human mind is capable of discovering them? Then we need that person or culture to believe. Do you hear the word? I already said it three times. To believe that conversely, the theoretical constructs and thoughts that we produce in our human mind, for example, mathematics, actually have reliable and predictable application to the world outside of it. You know, in my brain, I'm thinking, you know, every time I let this go and it falls to the ground. But that's in my mind. It's a construct of my mind. Is it really applicable to the real world? And how can I be sure that it's always applicable to the real world? Because I can make up any laws in my mind, but are they applicable really outside of my mind? Or am I just fantasizing? Am I just imagining things? Yeah. Dualism, for example, with the radical separation of mind and matter, may create some rational constructs that look like science. but it will never develop it into technology. The prime example is ancient Greece. They had all these philosophers, all these rational philosophers that could think of all kinds of different laws. And did they ever produce any technology? No. Okay? After the scientists, after we have the scientists, we need the experimenters. I mean, it's one thing for a scientist to discover the law. It's another thing for somebody to take that law and try to apply it back and see what do we experiment with this. We need someone who believes that his mind can actually interpret the results of his experiments. You know, you said, I drop it in my... But do I know if this really hit my foot? Or is it my foot just randomly hurting and just coincided with this thing falling on my foot? I'm not sure. I need to believe that there is a connection there. And therefore, we need to believe that what is called today the scientific method, repeatable, predictable results, is really a reliable tool. Any belief in ultimate chance will be destructive to the scientific method. Because if I believe, even for a minute, that the coincidence between this falling on my foot and the pain in my foot is purely chance, I'm not gonna develop any technology. Because I don't know if I can do it again and if it's going to happen again. We also need a division of labor between the experimenters. I mean, some experimenters will do one kind of experiment. Other experimenters will do another kind of experiment. So we need a group of people that believe that there is a unifying principle behind all experimentation, irrespective of time, geographical place, personal background, or the size of the shoes of the experimenter. We need them to believe that they can actually talk to each other and share information. Why should they believe such a thing? It is not taken for granted. We got to take it for granted. What about the economic part of it? In order to have a plane, we need someone to believe that the profits from their bicycle shop are better used for building the first experimental plane rather than spending it on wine, women, and song. Right? Why would they, in those days when they didn't have our modern cars and freeways, take all the parts all the way to North Carolina from Ohio to risk their lives to fly on this shaky thing? Okay? We need someone to believe that it's worth it to risk their life making the first flight at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. We need a society that believes in intellectual and physical property rights to assure the discoverer that he will be rewarded for his efforts and investments of time and resources. If the society doesn't believe that you deserve to be rewarded for it, you're not going to do anything about it. You're not going to build a plane. No one builds a plane overnight. Somebody has to put his money into it and wait and believe in the value of time and in the value of future profits over present consumption. It's a faith. It's not taken for granted. They must believe in the predictability of the market, and they must believe that they share common values with other entrepreneurs. Because no people get together to pull their money together for a project unless they believe the same things. Would you trust a Muslim and pull your money with them? Why not? The society also must believe in moral laws that punish those that embezzle the money. Or you'll keep your money under your bed. Then again, when the plane is built, we need pilots who believe the discoveries and the experiments of other people and that they're a reliable indicator that the plane is safe. You wouldn't believe how much faith is needed for somebody who is testing a plane or anybody's been underwater scuba diving. Anybody's jumped off a plane with a parachute? I can tell you, you need a lot of faith from personal experience. You're just looking down there. You know, I'm one of those few people that actually has more takeoffs than landings. But you need a lot of faith. Okay. Those pilots need faith in the principle of unity between the past, what's been in the past, and what they're going to experience in the future. The same applies to passengers. They need faith in the pilots, in the scientists, in the experimenters. Also, the passengers need to believe that their time is more valuable than the money they spend on a plane ticket. Right? Because you spend more money on a plane ticket than if you want to swim across the Atlantic. Okay? No one builds a plane if the society doesn't believe in saving time for better productive purposes. Now look what we said so far. While enumerating only a few of the most important prerequisites for the plane to even exist, we use the words believe and faith so many times. None of the material steps toward researching, experimenting, and building a plane would be taken unless we have people who believe all these things. A plane is not self-existent. It is a product of a belief system. Okay? And if we're going to discuss a plane in a rational way, we first need to take into consideration this belief system as the invisible reason for the existence of a plane. In fact, everything that's happening today, it's not a result of some materialism. It's not a result of some rationalism. It's always a matter of belief. Let me get to this. Let me show you the dark side of it. How much we trust the federal government. We live in a society that believes the federal government a little too much. Anybody remembers the first man on the moon? What did he say? I'm cold. How was he cold when he was in a perfect vacuum? There was no outside agent to exchange heat with. And the only exchange of heat was the sunshine beaming directly on him, but outside of him there was no air and nothing else to where his body temperature would go. When we put coffee in this thing, there is vacuum between the coffee and the world outside. And what happens to the coffee? Is the coffee cold? It stays hot. Why? It's not exchanging any heat with the world outside of it. And yet, what we heard then was that he was cold. And nobody stopped to think. It didn't make sense. Because we believe. So a plane needs, at the very bottom, certain beliefs in the society about man, about law, and about time. And above all, it needs certain beliefs about the unifying principle between all these. And no matter what unifying principle we choose for our beliefs, it is our God. And if Murray Rothbard wanted to start from the very beginning, he would have noticed that there's only one belief system that incorporates all these necessary beliefs to build a plane, and that is Christianity. Okay? It is no coincidence that planes, and not only planes, were first built in what nations? in Christian nations and were copied by everybody else. Rothbard claims at the beginning of his article that Christianity has played a central role in the Western civilization and contributed an important influence on the development of classical liberal thought. This is a quote from him. These thoughts are incorrect. The correct statement would be, only Christianity was the force that produced the West. Every other influence has played only a deconstructive role, and the only factor that actually built the most successful and most prosperous civilization in the history of this planet is Christianity. Because only Christianity produced the faith system that makes all this possible. Why? Even Rothbard's natural law is unthinkable without Christianity. He thinks his natural law can exist without Christianity. But had he spent the time to do research on how natural the natural law is, he would have discovered that the majority of the human beings in history would disagree with the naturalness of his natural law. He thinks he can go to nature and discover a law in it without God. The problem is, the only ones that would agree with him are Christians. And the only reason he sees law in nature is because he was born and lived in a Christian society. He took the concept from us, and then he cut away from it the only thing that makes the natural law natural: the God of the Bible. But without the God of the Bible, there's no natural law. And consequently, only that law is natural, which is revealed in the Bible. In proclaiming some kind of natural law that doesn't need God, he's pretty much like those Muslim terrorists and Muslim Islamic fundamentalists who, in order to fight against the West, need Western guns, Western ammo, Western radio stations, Western internet, Western clothes, Western oil drills, and all that stuff. This is what Bill Rothbard is like when he says, is there a Christian way to fly a plane? And there is a humorous clip online actually about Islamic insurgents. And the guy is bragging about studying in the bloody American University of Cairo while fighting against bloody Americans. So, to answer Mr. Rothbard's question, and for you to answer anybody who tells you God is silent in these areas, there's only one way to fly a plane: the Christian way. All other ways, everybody else must borrow worldview, presuppositions, and faith from Christianity in order to have a plane in the first place to fly it. The fact that a non-Christian uses or flies a plane does not make the plane less Christian. It just makes the unbeliever hypocritical. Just like a socialist who wants to use capitalist money to give to the poor, an unbeliever who wants to fly a plane wants to take something that is Christian from the very beginning and then brag about flying it in a non-Christian way. Planes are Christian from beginning to end, and so is civilization, science, technology, and free markets, because nothing else could produce them. Thank you. Don't give me ideas. Don't give me ideas. All right. Any questions? What's that? Oh, I don't know. You got to go there and it's an Australian kind of I don't even know the name of the TV show, but it's an Australian show. They got a lot of funny stuff. Oh, what's that TV show about the Islamic insurgents that that brags about being having studied at the Bloody University, Bloody American University of Cairo? It's you got to go to YouTube and go Islamic insurgents Australian fun comedy or something like this. You'll find it. I know the exact address.
Maybe if you Google Bloody University.
Yeah, probably.
Boy, I got a degree in chemistry. We're talking about, you know, laws and so forth. And the thing that always impressed me was that in chemistry, you've got all these different reactions. You've got the atom and so forth, and they're made up of protons, neutrons, electrons, so forth. Nobody's ever seen an electron. You know, you talk about faith.
Yeah.
And yet, these particles that they talk about, and then you get into...
figment of imagination.
Quarks, and you get into all these different theoretical particles. Nobody's ever seen pi mesons, you know, all these... these people have never seen that, and yet they have to have the faith. And when you talk about establishing laws and predictability, you're right about, you know, you do experiments. You can do them all over the world, and they have common theorems, which a theorem is just a postulate to a truth that has to be proven by experimentation and over again. And so, but it always impressed me that even that people that are, you know, what's his name, Hawking's?
Yeah.
Even he... he's supposed to be, you know, the one of the smartest men in the world, and a theoretical physicist. But even he has come to the point where he is. He's always said, "Well, you know, the beginning had to be so perfect that there had to be somebody in control to establish it." So he's, you know, he doesn't admit there's a God, but he's a supreme being.
Yeah, something's got to be out there. It's just not God.
Yeah, it's weird, but
yeah, the unknown God.
Personal, but anyway.
Can you explain why, in 1000 A.D., I've heard this, that Muslim Baghdad was the most advanced city in the world? Is that true?
I don't know where they got this. Statistics. I'll tell you another thing. We've been talking about, been arguing with Muslims, and I discovered one thing that was very interesting. First of all the battles against the Muslim world, I mean, the reason that the Christian world was able to win was because of technology. I mean, the Christian world has never been more populous than the Muslim world all the way until the 17th century. Before the 17th century, for example, in the times of the First Crusade, the Muslim world was six times larger in terms of territory and resources, and 15 times larger in terms of population. From a Muslim perspective, Christendom was a bunch of little principalities at the edge of the big Muslim world. They were so surprised when actually these little guys attacked them, you know, because they couldn't expect. I mean, they couldn't believe that somebody so small. It's about the same. It's about the same if today Poland attacks the United States. We're going to be looking at it, huh? Who attacks us? Poland? I mean, this was about the same thing. Yeah, ratio of population and resources. But what's more important here is that if you look at the history of the Muslim world, they have always stolen technologies from other nations around them, specifically from Christianity. Even when they took over, when they took Constantinople, the big guns that they used, the big cannons that they used, were produced in Hungary. They were not produced in the Muslim world. A lot of Muslim propaganda goes around Saladin, the big Muslim warrior who fought against Richard Lionheart. and how when he took Jerusalem, he didn't kill the Christian population, so he was very tolerant. Historically, though, if you go before that, he killed about 60,000 of his own people because he didn't want to obey him. Don't look like the icon of toleration, necessarily. You know, if you killed 60,000 of your own people, I mean, you would believe this guy's just because they don't obey him. I mean, this guy's not tolerant at all. Why didn't he kill the Christians? And the reason he didn't kill the Christians is because at the time, Christians were the only ones in that area who actually knew the technology of blacksmithing, producing steel. And he needed steel. I mean, it was an economic decision. And what saved Christians at the time is their superior knowledge of technology. It was not, and they continued being superior to Muslims in terms of technology, because Islam cannot produce any kind of technology, any kind of science. It can only steal it from other people.
That's what I heard about Baghdad. The scientists they had in Baghdad were either Christians or Jews.
Jewish, yeah.
And they were not Muslims.
No, they didn't have any Muslims for science. That's why they tolerated them.
Ron may have indirectly answered my question, but I want you to play this out with me because my apologetics are not as sophisticated as yours. How am I going to answer my liberal/socialist contemporary that tells me an atheist, communist regime put the first satellite in orbit?
Well, I can tell you this. China produced, pagan China produced the first paper. But that didn't mean that they knew how to use it. Because it's more than just put a satellite in orbit. Because when you have people starving on the ground and you have a satellite in orbit, that doesn't make you more advanced. Well, it only makes you more tyrannical, but doesn't make you more advanced.
Tie it into Christianity for me.
Okay. You need a culture that actually spreads that knowledge to everybody. You need a culture that makes everybody not only smarter, not only more intelligent, not only more informed about things, but also more able to increase productivity, because this is the very nature of the Dominion Covenant, increasing productivity, but increasing productivity so that everybody can profit from it. Okay, if we're talking about rich people, if we're talking about specific thing that is better than somebody else, we have examples in India of people who are in the Muslim world, of people that are richer than anybody here in America. You know, have billions of dollars, but it's one guy. Everybody else is poor, you know. In Bulgaria, you have the gypsy communities that live in clans, and the boss of the clan has a Mercedes-Benz or BMW, and everybody else is in a horse cart, you know, or mud houses or something like that. But what Christianity does is it increases the knowledge, it increases the wisdom, the understanding, and also the economic welfare of everybody in the society. This is what Christianity is. And if you go to the Old Testament, you will see that the promise of the New Testament in Jeremiah 31:34 is that everyone will know. Not just a few people will profit from what we have, but everyone will know. So this is also part of the whole thing. Now, if they put somebody in orbit, let's not forget that the Soviet Union was not acting in a vacuum, in a socialist, you know, vacuum, and there was no capitalism. They didn't steal any scientific things from capitalism. They did steal a lot.
Can we then say that they had faith, but because eventually the Soviet Union collapsed, their system wasn't working because it wasn't based on the belief system of Christianity.
Yeah, we can't look only at one thing. You can't change only one thing. I mean, you got to look at the whole culture. That's why I said not only you need one scientist who believes, but also you need a whole culture that believes it. Okay, and they didn't have a culture that actually believed it.
Well,
they could have not produced the other.
What I get out of what you just taught is the belief that there are reliable laws.
Yeah.
Is Christianity.
It comes from Christianity. It's a product of Christianity and only of Christianity, if nothing else.
If you believe there are reliable laws, you got to go back to the beginning. Why are there reliable laws? So there's a God.
Yeah, where do they come from?
The laws of nature. So that's Christian. And that's only Christian.
Yeah.
Even for pagans.
Yeah. They got to steal it from us.
Yeah. So they sent an astronaut up there. They had to use Christian ideas. They had to assume there are certain reliable laws.
Yeah.
Right. That's Christian.
Yeah. They got to steal it from us.
That's what you taught me. That's what I understand.
Bo, I was thinking about Japan. You know, after the war, they were competing. MacArthur went out over there and, you know, they set up a program for them. Mm-hmm. A reconstruction program. And then there was a fellow from the United States that went over there. They start producing goods, but they were inferior. I mean, when you got something from Japan that was junk, and everybody knew it. Whether the fellow, I'm trying to think of his name. And then, Deming, yeah, there you go. Richard Deming mm-hmm. went over there, and he taught them about quality control. And he set up a system over there where they started producing products that were superior to what we have now. I mean, when you look at the cars they produce and how well they last compared to some of our American cars. But you can see it was the influence, the American influence, or Christian influence, that brought them out of their depression and, you know, whatever. But I mean, it's
and then South
you
Korea,
see it over and over again.
And then South Korea kind of pulled ahead of even of Japan because 40% of the South Korean population is Christian, you know. And in South Korea, it actually has basis in the culture. And Japan right now has been in a economic recession since the 90s for about 20 years because there is no moral and religious foundation in the culture. While South Korea is exploding economically, and look in our streets. I mean. How many South Korean cars did we have 10 years ago? Yeah. You know, and the most beautiful cars right now on the streets are Hyundai. Just 10 years ago, Hyundai was... Nobody drives Hyundai.
Yeah.
Look at their cars today.
I was going to say one more thing about the Russian. After the war, United States, you know, got a number of the German scientists, Wernher von Braun and Einstein and a bunch of these guys to come over here, you know, and split the atom and so forth. But Russia also got a number of scientists. And those scientists, you know, and you got, you know, the Germans were influenced by Martin Luther and, you know, those people.
Yeah.
Ask a question. Going back to the capitalist and the socialist and the surplus, is what we know as the black market considered biblical, even though it violates?
Of course it's biblical.
So, like, the black market that's out there?
Of course it's biblical.
Okay.
Anytime the government tries to control and regulate the economic behavior, the government is stepping out of its biblical boundaries. And any resistance against the government in that area, any resistance against the government that is not a servant of God, is a biblical resistance, and the black market is exactly that. The black market is a resistance to the government. What if tomorrow the Congress gets together and say, we're going to have 100% tax? What are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to go into the black market before you know it. I tell you what, within the next second, I'll be a black marketeer. I'm going to be thinking, what do I need to produce to be there on the market and produce that? So this is Christian resistance. This is legitimate Christian resistance against a satanic government. That's what the black market is. And we got to get involved in it, actually, I think. That's a legitimate area of resistance. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, just first to Ron's point of what he learned, I learned the same thing from what you taught this morning. But, that the laws are, it's Christian that they're attributed to natural laws, to God. And I guess where the Western world is ahead or has been able to produce these things. And it's because, well, we attribute it to the God, but then if we take it even further and it's the revealed God, and we learn about this God, and we attribute it to the one true God, and then we discover who he is, and we learn about his ways. I mean, that just, the wisdom of that obviously will produce even more and more, more and more of everything. But so I think that's where we're at. But it was just a question about when you mentioned the vacuum, the astronaut landing on the moon, saying he was cold. Could you elaborate on that? I don't know if I followed.
What I said is I don't believe.
Somebody
I
had
believe
to
the
ask
whole
it.
Thing was propaganda. I believe that the way they explained it, you cannot land a man on the moon. Physically, for somebody who knows physics, the whole thing was nonsense. You cannot feel cold if you're out there because you have vacuum. You have vacuum in it. Between this wall and the inside wall, you have vacuum. And that vacuum is a thermal isolation device. That means that there cannot be an exchange of heat, an exchange of heat between what's inside and the vacuum. That's what keeps it warm. Now, if that guy was there on the moon and he got out of that module and he was warm and he got out there, he's in a big thermos. That's what he is. It's a big thermos. Okay? What did he exchange heat with? Not only he would stay that way, he would overheat because there was another input of heat into his body, and that was the direct sunlight. Stay in the direct sunlight and see how much heat your body starts. I mean, no, we don't know anything about that in Texas. And even here, you have the direct heat moderated by several hundred miles of air. That means that heat is coming, but air is taking that heat, and only part of it gets into our body. And he is there directly exposed to the sunlight. That sunlight is bombarding him with all the heavy particles, all the energy that's getting into that suit. He said that he felt cold. He should have felt warmer and warmer and warmer because there is no heat coming out of his body. There's nowhere for that heat to go out. You think of space as something that is very cold, but space is neither cold nor hot because there's nothing out there. Cold and hot are properties of matter, and it's vacuum. He was lying. He was not on the moon. That's what I believe. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Bo, I had a question real quick because we talk about, you know, the origin of law, things to that effect. I've heard a lot of people say that, well, point to arithmetic coming from the Arab world. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because
I've talked before about it, and we don't have too much time because I will need at least an hour.
Okay. Maybe you can point me to the reference.
Yeah, and I talked, there is a Sunday school lesson here of, I think, about 2 years back, right, that I talk about math and that. Yeah, one more.
Don't you think if you believe we didn't land on the moon is what you're saying?
Yeah.
The communist nations were watching us like a hawk. If we didn't land on the moon, they would have had proof. They would have, you know, they'd have aired it out back then.
All right.
The only problem I have with that. I'm not saying we did or we didn't.
That's a very good question, by the way, and I'll answer that question in the following way. If they said at the time, and you got to understand how communists were thinking. They had a longer term view at the time in the 60s and the 70s than they had later. Okay. And I lived in the communist country, and I was trained to be a communist. I can tell you how they thought. So I know how they thought. So their thinking was at the time, if you remember, at the time, there was less communist propaganda against the West, and there was more use of what was inside the United States. Okay, so they were expecting that eventually somebody will discover the truth in the United States, and that will bring much more damage much more shame to the free world than if they said anything against it. That's what their thinking was. They were longer term in the 60s and the 70s. They were looking farther down the road than they did in the 80s. So that's why they didn't do it. That was a strategic decision, as over against making a tactical move, which will fail.